This is Audible.
Dreamscape presents Boyfriend Material by Alexis Hall, narrated by Joe Jameson. Chapter 1. I've never seen the point of fancy dress parties. You have two choices. Either you make a massive effort and wind up looking like a dick, or you make no effort and wind up looking like a dick. And my problem, as always, was not knowing what kind of dick I wanted to be. I'd pretty much committed to the no-effort strategy. Then I'd panicked at the last minute, made an ill-fated attempt to track down somewhere that sold costumes, and found myself in one of those weirdly high-streety sex shops that flog red lingerie and pink dildos to people with no real interest in either. Which is why, when I rocked up to a party already well into the too hot, too loud, too crowded stage of its life cycle, I was wearing a pair of problematically sexualized black lace bunny ears. I swear I used to be good at this sort of thing, but I was out of practice, and looking like a cut-rate rent boy serving a very specific fetish was not the ideal way to make a triumphant return to the scene. Worse, I'd arrived so late that all the other lonely shit people had given up and gone home already. Somewhere in that pit of flashy lights, bleepy music, and sweat were my actual friends. I knew that because our WhatsApp group, currently called Queer Comes the Sun, had devolved into 100 variations on the theme of Where the Fuck is Luke? But all I could see were people I vaguely thought vaguely knew people who vaguely knew me. Wriggling my way to the bar, I squinted at the chalkboard listing the night's bespoke cocktails, and eventually ordered a slow, comfortable conversation about pronouns up against the wall, since it seemed like it would be both nice to drink and accurately descriptive of my chances of scoring that evening, or indeed, ever. I should probably explain why I was sipping on a non-binary beverage while wearing the world's most middle-class excuse for fetish gear in a basement in Shoreditch. But honestly, I was beginning to wonder that myself. Basically, there's this guy called Malcolm, who I know because everybody knows Malcolm. I'm pretty sure he's a stockbroker, or a banker, or whatever. But in the evenings, by which I mean some evenings, by which I mean about one evening a week, he DJs at this transgender, gender-fluid club night called Surf and Turf at the Cellar. And tonight was his tea party. His Mad Hatter's tea party. Because that's Malcolm. Right now, he was at the back of the room in a purple topper, a striped tailcoat, leather trousers, and not much else, laying down what I think they call sick beats. Or maybe they don't. Maybe that's something nobody has ever said ever. When I was going through my club kid phase, I didn't even bother to ask the names of my hookups, let alone make notes on the terminology. I sighed and turned my attention back to my comfortable lack of a screw. There should really be a word for the feeling you get when you do a thing you don't particularly want to do to support somebody else, but then realise they didn't actually need you, and nobody would have noticed if you'd stayed home in your pyjamas, eating Nutella straight from the jar. Anyway, that. I was feeling that. And probably I should have just left. Except then I'd have been the arsehole who showed up for Malcolm's tea party, made no effort with his costume, drank an eighth of a drink, and then fucked off without talking to anybody. Pulling out my phone, I sent a forlorn, "I'm here, where are you?" message to the group, only to see the clock of doom pop up beside it. Who'd have thought an event that took place literally underground and surrounded by concrete would have bad mobile phone reception?
"You do realise," warm breath brushed my cheek, "that those ears aren't even white."
I turned to find a stranger standing next to me. Quite a cute stranger, with that pointy, foxy look I've always found weirdly charming.
"Yeah, but I was late, and you're not wearing a costume at all."
He grinned, looking even pointier and even foxier and even more charming. Then flicked his lapel aside to reveal a sticky label that read, "Nobody."
I'm guessing that's an irritatingly obscure reference. I only wish I had such eyes, the king remarked in a fretful tone, to be able to see nobody.
You smug git. That made him laugh.
Fancy dress parties bring out the worst in me.
It wasn't quite the longest I'd spoken to a guy without fucking the whole thing up, but it was definitely climbing the leaderboard. What was important here was not to panic and try to protect myself by transforming into an unbearable wanker or a gargantuan manslut. I hate to imagine who they bring out the best in.
Yeah, that...
Another grin, another flash of his teeth.
Would be Malcolm.
Everything brings out the best in Malcolm. He could make people celebrate having to pay 10p for a carrier bag.
Please don't give him ideas. By the way,
he leaned a little closer.
I'm Cam, but since you almost certainly misheard me, I'll answer to any one-syllable name with a vowel in the middle.
Nice to meet you, Bob.
You smug git.
Even through the strobes, I caught the glitter of his eyes and found myself wondering what colour they were away from the shadows and artificial rainbows of the dance floor. That was a bad sign. That was perilously close to liking someone, and look where that had got me.
You're Luke Fleming, aren't you?
He asked. Why, hello, other shoe. I'd been wondering when you were going to drop. F my effing L.
Actually, I said, like I always said, it's Luke O'Donnell. But you are John Fleming's kid.
What's it to you? He blinked.
Well, nothing, but when I asked Angie,
Malcolm's girlfriend, currently dressed as Alice, because of course she was,
who the hot grumpy guy was, she said, oh, that's Luke, he's John Fleming's kid.
I didn't like that being the thing people told each other about me. But then again, what was the alternative? That's Luke, his career's in the toilet. That's Luke, he's not had a stable relationship in 5 years. That's Luke. Where did it all go wrong?
Yeah, that's me.
Cam folded his elbows on the bar.
This is exciting. I've never met anyone famous before. Should I be pretending I really like your dad or really hate your dad?
I've never even met him. A cursory Google would have told him that, so it wasn't like he was getting a major scoop here.
So I don't particularly care. Probably for the best, because I can only remember, like, one of his songs. I think it was about having a green ribbon around his hat.
No, that's Steel Eye Span.
Oh, wait, John Fleming's Rights of Man.
Yeah, but I can see how you got them confused. He gave me a sharp look.
They sound nothing alike, do they?
Well, there's a couple of subtle differences. Steel Eye's more folk rock, whereas R.O.M.'s more prog rock. Steel Eye used a lot of violins, whereas Dad's a flautist. Also, the lead singer of Steel Eye Span is a woman.
Okay.
He flicked another smile at me, less abashed than I would have been in his position.
So I don't know what I'm talking about. My dad's a big fan, though. He's got all the records. Keeps them in the attic with the bell-bottoms he hasn't been able to get into since 1979.
It was beginning to sink in that, about 8 million years ago, Cam had described me as hot and grumpy. Except right now it was clearly 80-20 in favour of grumpy.
Everyone's dad's a fan of my dad. That must mess with your head.
A bit.
And it must be even weirder with the TV thing.
Kind of. I poked listlessly at my drink.
I get recognised more, but hey, your dad's that guy off that stupid talent show is marginally better than hey, your dad's that guy who was in the news last week for headbutting a policeman, then vomiting on a judge while off his face on heroin and toilet duck. At least it's interesting. The most scandalous thing my dad's ever done was shake a bottle of ketchup without realising the lid was off.
I laughed, in spite of myself.
I can't believe you're giggling at my childhood trauma. The kitchen looked like something out of Hannibal. Mom still brings it up every time she's annoyed, even if it's not actually Dad she's annoyed at.
Yeah, my mum brings up my dad when I piss her off as well, except it's less, "This is just like the time your father got a tomato-y condiment all over the kitchen," and more, "This is just like the time your father said he'd come home for my birthday, but instead he stayed in LA snorting cocaine off a prostitute's breasts."
Cam blinked. Eesh. Shit. Half a cocktail and a pretty smile, and I was singing like a lovable urchin on a barricade in France. This was the sort of stuff that ended up in the papers. John Fleming's other secret coke shame. Or maybe, like father, like son, John Fleming Jr.'s childhood behaviour compared to father's drug-fueled rampages. Or worst of all, still crazy after all these years, Odile O'Donnell rages at son about 80s Fleming hooker binge. This was why I should never leave the house, or talk to humans. Especially not humans I wanted to like me. "Listen," I said, with zero poker face, despite knowing how badly this could go wrong. "My mum's a really good person, and she brought me up on her own, and has gone through a lot, so, like, can you please forget I said that?" He gave me the type of look you give someone when you're mentally shifting them from the box that says attractive to the box that says weird. "I'm not going to tell her. I don't even know her. And yes, I might have come over to hit on you, but we're quite a long way from meeting the parents."
Sorry. I'm just protective of her."
"And you think she needs to be protected from random guys you meet in bars?"
Well, I'd ruined this, because the answer was basically yes, in case you go to the tabloids, because that's the thing that actually happens to me. But I couldn't tell him without putting the idea in his head. I mean, assuming it wasn't there already, and he wasn't playing me like a flute or a fiddle, depending which 70s band he thought I was in. So that left option B. Allow this funny, sexy man I'd like to at least try for a one-night stand with to believe I was a paranoid creep who spent way too much time thinking about his mother. I swallowed, feeling about as desirable as a roadkill sandwich. "Can we go back to the bit where you'd come over to hit on me?" There was a longer silence than I would have liked. Then Cam smiled, if slightly warily.
"Sure."
Another silence.
"So," I tried, "this hitting on me thing you're doing, I've got to say it's pretty minimalist." "Well, my original plan was to, you know, try to talk to you a bit and see how it went, and then maybe try to kiss you or something. But you kind of torpedoed that strategy, so now I don't know what to do."
I drooped.
"I'm sorry. You didn't do anything wrong. I'm just really bad at..."
I tried to find a word that properly encapsulated my recent dating history.
"Everything."
Perhaps I was imagining it, but I could almost see Cam deciding whether or not he could be arsed with me. To my mild surprise, he seemed to come down on the side of arsed.
"Everything,"
he repeated, and tweaked the tip of my bunny ear in a fashion I chose to interpret as encouraging. This was a good sign, right? This had to be a good sign. Or was it a terrible sign? What was wrong with him that he wasn't running away screaming? Okay, no, I was in my head, and that was the worst place for anyone to be, especially me, and I needed to say something light and flirty and right the fuck now.
"I might be okay at the kissing."
Cam leaned in a little farther. Holy shit, he was actually going for this?
"I'm not sure I trust your judgment. Perhaps I better check for myself."
All right. So he checked for himself. And I was okay at the kissing. I mean, I thought I was okay at the kissing. God, I hope I was okay at the kissing.
"Well?"
I asked, a moment later, sounding relaxed, playful, and not at all desperate and insecure. His face was close enough that I could see all the tantalizing details, like the thickness of his eyelashes, the beginnings of stubble along his jaw, and the crinkles at the corners of his lips.
I'm not sure I can draw an accurate conclusion from a single data point.
Ooh, sciencey.
We expanded the data set, and by the time we were done, he had me pressed up against the corner of the bar, and my hands were tucked into the back pockets of his jeans, in a really half-assed attempt to pretend I wasn't blatantly feeling him up. Which was when I remembered that he knew my name, and my dad's name, and probably my mum's name, and quite possibly everything that had ever been written about me. And all I had in return was that he was called Cam, and tasted nice.
"Are you?"
I said, breathlessly. And in response to his confused look, "You know, sciencey. You don't look sciencey."
"Oh, no,"
he grinned, all foxy and delicious.
"That was just an excuse to keep kissing you."
"What do you do then?"
"I freelance, mainly for sites that wish they were BuzzFeed."
I knew it. I fucking knew it. He had been far too eager to overlook my many, many flaws.
"You're a journalist."
"That's a pretty generous term for it. I write those lists of X things about Y where you won't believe Z that everybody hates but seems to read anyway."
12 things you didn't know about Luke O'Donnell. Number 8 will shock you.
"And sometimes I make those quizzes where it's like, pick 8 pictures of kittens and we'll tell you which John Hughes character you are."
The rational version of Luke, the one from the parallel universe where my dad wasn't a famous shithead and my ex-boyfriend hadn't sold all my secrets to Piers Morgan, tried to tell me I was overreacting. Unfortunately, I wasn't listening. Cam tilted his head quizzically.
"What's wrong? Look, I know it's not exactly a sexy job, and I don't even have the comfort of saying someone has to do it, because we totally don't. But you've gone weird again."
"Sorry, it's complicated."
"Complicated can be interesting."
He went up on tiptoes to smooth a lock of hair behind my ear for me.
"And we've got the kissing down. We've just got to work on the talking."
I gave what I hoped wasn't a sickly grin.
"I'd rather stick with what I'm good at."
"Tell you what, I'll ask you a question, and if I like the answer, you get to kiss me again."
I'm not sure.
"Let's start small. You know what I do. How about you?"
My heart was racing, and not in a fun way. But as questions went, that was harmless, right? It was information at least 200 spam bots already had.
"I work for a charity."
"Wow, noble. I'd say I'd always wanted to do something like that, but I'm far too shallow."
He turned his face up to mine, and I kissed him nervously.
"Favorite ice cream flavor?"
"Mint choc chip."
Another kiss.
"Book that literally everyone else has read, but you haven't."
"All of them."
He drew back.
"You're not getting kissed for that. It's a total cop-out."
"No, seriously, all of them. To Kill a Mockingbird, The Catcher in the Rye, anything Dickens ever wrote, All Quiet on the Western Front, that one about the time traveller's wife, Harry Potter."
"You really do own your illiteracy, don't you?"
"Yeah, I'm thinking about moving to America and running for public office."
He laughed and kissed me, staying close this time, body pressed to mine, breath against my skin.
"Okay, weirdest place you've ever had sex?"
"Is that for number 8?
I asked, with a bleaty laugh that was meant to show I was incredibly cool and unconcerned.
"Number 8 what?"
"You know, 12 celebrities' kids who like to fuck in weird places. Number 8 will shock you."
"Wait."
He froze.
"Do you honestly think I'm kissing you for a listicle?"
"No, I mean, no, no."
He gazed at me for a long, horrible moment.
"You do, don't you? I told you it was complicated." "That's not complicated. That's insulting." "It's..."
I'd pulled this back before. I could pull it back again. It wasn't meant to be. It's not about you. This time, there was no ear tweaking. How is it not about me if you genuinely have this concern about my possible behaviour? I just have to be careful. For the record, I sounded extremely dignified when I said this, and not at all pathetic. What the hell would I even write? I met a has-been's kid at a party. Celebrity's gay son is gay shock. Well, it sounds like it'd be a step up from what you usually write. His mouth fell open, and I realised I might have gone the tiniest bit too far. Wow, I was about to say I wasn't sure which of us was the arsehole here, but thanks for clearing that up. No, I said quickly. It was always me, trust me, I know. Really not sure that helps. I mean, I can't figure out what's worse. That you think I'd fuck a mildly famous person to get ahead. Or that you think if I was going to make such a profoundly degrading career choice, the person I'd pick to make it with was you. I swallowed. All good points. Very well made. Shit on a hot tin roof. I should have listened to Angie. You are a world of not worth it. He stalked off into the crowd, presumably to find someone less fucked up, leaving me alone with my lopsided bunny ears and a profound sense of personal failure. Although, I guess I'd accomplished two things tonight. I'd successfully demonstrated my support for a man who in no way needed it, and I'd finally proved beyond all reasonable objection that nobody in their right mind would date me. I was a cagey, grumpy, paranoid mess who would find a way to ruin even the most basic human interaction. I leaned against the bar and stared at the basement full of strangers having a far better time than me, at least two of whom were probably having a conversation right now about what a terrible human being I was. The way I saw it, I had two options. I could suck it up, act like an adult, find my actual friends and try to make the best of the evening, or I could run home, drink alone, and add this to the list of things I was unsuccessfully pretending had never happened. 2 seconds later, I was on the stairs. 8 seconds later, I was out in the street. And 19 seconds later, I was tripping over my own feet and landing flat on my face in the gutter. Well, wasn't that just the ill-fitting crown on my inbred Habsburg prince of an evening? And no way was it coming back to haunt me. Chapter 2. It came back to haunt me. And the way it haunted me was a Google alert that threatened to vibrate my phone off the bedside table. And yes, I'm very aware that tracking what people are saying about you on the internet is generally the act of a tosser, or a narcissist, or a narcissistic tosser, but I'd learned the hard way that it's better to know what's out there. I flailed, sending a different piece of vibrating technology, for gentlemen wishing to explore a more sophisticated kind of pleasure, spinning to the floor, and finally managed to close my fingers round my phone with all the grace of a teenager trying to hit second base. I didn't want to look, but if I didn't, I was going to throw up the sticky mess of dread, hope, and uncertainty that had turned my insides to baby food. Probably it was less bad than I feared. Usually it was less bad than I feared. Except occasionally it wasn't. Peeping through my eyelashes like a small child braving an episode of Doctor Who from behind the sofa cushions, I checked my notifications. And I could breathe again. It was okay, though obviously in an ideal world, pictures of me lying in the gutter outside the cellar in my bunny ears wouldn't have been splashed across every third-rate gossip site, from celeb bitchy to yeah. And in a truly ideal world, my definition of okay wouldn't have sunk quite that low. But with my life being a never-ending pit of suck, my dismaydar has gone through some serious recalibrations over the years. I mean, at least the pictures showed me fully clothed and without anybody's cock in my mouth. So, you know, win. Today's nail in the coffin of my digital reputation had a strong like-father-like-son theme, because there's a magic porridge pot's worth of footage of John Fleming making a tit of himself out there. And I guess bad boy Johnny's wild child son collapses in drugs, sex, booze, shame is a better headline than Man Trips Over in Street. Sighing, I let my phone thunk to the floor. Turns out the one thing worse than having a famous father who blew up his career like a champagne supernova is having a famous father who's making a fucking comeback. I'd just about learned to live with being compared to my reckless, self-destructive absentee father. But now he'd cleaned up his act and was playing the wise old mentor every Sunday on ITV, I was being compared unfavourably to my reckless, self-destructive absentee father. And that was a level of bullshit I was not emotionally prepared for. I should have known better than to read the comments, but my eyes slipped and fell on Well Actually 69, who'd been massively upvoted for suggesting a reality TV show in which John Fleming tries to put his junkie son back on the straight and narrow, a show which the other Jill from Peckham declared that she would watch the shit out of. I knew, in the grand scheme of things, none of this mattered. The internet was forever, and there was no getting away from that. But by tomorrow, or the day after, I would be below the fold, or whatever the E equivalent of the fold was. As good as forgotten, until the next time someone wanted a twist on the John Fleming story. Except I still felt fucking terrible, and the longer I lay there, the fucking terribler I felt. I tried to take some comfort in the fact that at least Cam hadn't put me on a list of 12 pricks who will freak out on you in a nightclub. But as comfort went, that landed somewhere between cold and scant. Truth be told, I'd never been the best at self-care. Self-recrimination I had down. Self-loathing I could do in my sleep, and often did. So here I was, a 28-year-old man suddenly feeling an overwhelming need to call his mother because he was sad. Because the one upside of my dad being who he is that my mum is who she is. You can wiki this stuff, but the TLDR version is that back in the 80s, she was essentially a French-Irish Adele with bigger hair. And at about the time Bros were wondering when they'd be famous, and Cliff Richard was spilling mistletoe and wine on a million unsuspecting Christmases, she and Dad were caught up in this love you, hate you, can't live without you thing that produced two collaborative albums, one solo album, and me. Well, technically I came before the solo album, which happened when Dad realised he wanted to be famous and wasted more than he wanted to be in our lives. Welcome Ghosts was the last thing Mum ever wrote, but honestly, it was the last thing she had to. Nearly every year, the BBC or ITV or some movie studio uses a track from it over a sad scene or an angry scene or a scene it doesn't fit, but we'll cash the check anyway. Stumbling out of bed, I adopted out of long-ingrained habit the Quasimodo pose required for anyone over 5'6" to move around my flat without getting clocked in the face by an Eve, which, given I'm 6'4", is the accommodational equivalent of having chosen to drive a Mini Cooper. I'd leased the place with Miles, my ex, back when it had been romantic to live in the 21st century equivalent of a garret in Shepherd's Bush. Now it was rapidly becoming pathetic, being alone, stuck in a job that was going nowhere, and still unable to afford a home that wasn't mostly the underside of a roof. Of course, it might also have helped if I'd tidied it, like ever. Shoving a pile of socks off the sofa, I curled up and got to FaceTiming.
"Allô, Luke, mon canton,"
said Mum.
"Did you see your father's old package last night?"
I gave a gasp of actual horror before remembering the whole package was the name of his stupid TV show. "No, I was out with friends."
"You should watch it. I'm sure it will be on the catch-up."
"I don't want to watch it." She gave the most Gallic of shrugs. I'm convinced she plays up the French thing, but I can't really blame her for it because all she got from her father was his name. Well, that and a pallor Susie Sue would envy. In any case, even if having a dad who runs out on you isn't genetic, in our family it's definitely hereditary.
"Your father," she declared, "he has not aged well."
"Good to know."
"His head is bald as an egg now, and a funny shape. He looks like that chemistry teacher with the cancer."
This was news to me. But then I hadn't exactly gone out of my way to keep in contact with my old school. To be honest, I haven't exactly gone out of my way to keep in contact with people who live on the wrong side of London. Mr. Beazle has cancer.
Not him, the other one.
Another thing about my mum, relationship to reality, questionable at best. Do you mean Walter White?
Oui, oui, and you know, I think he is too old to be hopping around with a flute these days.
We're talking about Dad, right? Because otherwise Breaking Bad got hella weird in its later seasons.
Of course your father. He will probably break a hip.
Well, I grinned, we can hope.
He bid on a young lady with a harmonica. It was a good choice, I think, because she was one of the most talented, but she went with one of the boys from Blue instead. I enjoyed that very much.
If left unchecked, Mum could talk about reality TV basically forever. Unfortunately, with Well Actually 69 and Friends buzzing around my head like internet hornets, my attempt to check her came out as, I got papped yesterday.
Oh, baby, again? I'm sorry.
My own shrug was very non-Gallic.
You know how these things are.
Her tone softened reassuringly.
Always a squall in a shot glass.
That made me smile. She always does. I know. It's just every time it happens, even when it's trivial, it reminds me.
You know, it was not your fault what happened. What Miles did, it was not even truly about you.
I snorted. It was specifically all about me.
Someone else's actions may affect you, but what other people choose to do is about them.
We were both quiet for a moment. Will it ever stop hurting?
No.
Mum shook her head.
But it will stop mattering.
I wanted to believe her. I really did. She was, after all, living proof of her words.
Do you want to come round, mon canton?
It was only an hour or so away if I catched a lift from Epsom, 1.6 stars on Google, station. But while I could more or less justify ringing my mum every time something bad happened to me, literally running back to her literal house slipped under even my low bar for self-respect.
Judy and I have found this new show that we are watching,
offered Mum, in a way that I think was intended to be encouraging. Oh?
Yes, it is very intriguing. It is called RuPaul's Drag Race. Have you heard of it? We were not sure we would like it at first because we thought it was about monster trucks, but you can imagine how happy we were when we discovered it was about men who like to dress as women. Why are you laughing?
Because I love you. Very much.
You should not be laughing, Luke. You would be very impressed. We are often gagging on the eleganza. That means...
I'm familiar with Drag Race. Probably more familiar than you. This was what happened when you won an Emmy. Your audience became your audience's mums.
Then you should come, mon cher.
Mum lives in Pucklethroop in the Wold, this tiny chocolate box of a village where I grew up, and spends her days getting into scrapes with her best friend, Judith Chumley Faffle. If I stayed home, I could try and achieve grown-up things like plates and clean clothes. Although in practice, I would probably pick up my Google alerts until they bled.
I am making my special curry.
Okay, that settled it. Fuck no.
Luke, I think you are very rude about my special curry.
Yes, because I prefer my arsehole not on fire. Mum was pouting.
For a gay, you are far too sensitive about your asshole.
How about we don't talk about my asshole anymore?
You brought it up? Anyway, Judy loves my curries.
Sometimes I think Judy must love Mum. God knows why else you would brave her cooking. Probably because you've spent the last 25 years systematically murdering her taste buds.
Well, you know where we are if you change your mind.
Thanks, Mum. Talk to you soon.
Hello, darling. Bye, Z's.
Without Mum talking 19 to the dozen about reality TV, my home was suddenly very quiet, my day very long seeming. Between work, friends, acquaintances, and sporadic attempts to get laid, I usually manage to use my flat as an overpriced, badly maintained hotel, turning up only to crash out and leave again the next morning. Except Sundays. Sundays were tricky, or had got tricky as the years had got away from me. At university, they'd been for brunch and regretting what you'd done on Saturday, and sleepy afternoons. Then, one by one, I'd lost my friends to dinners with in-laws, or decorating the nursery, or the pleasures of a day at home. It wasn't that I blamed them for their changing lives, and I didn't want what they had. I wasn't cut out for it, since, as far as I could remember, Sundays with Miles had spun pretty quickly from marathon sex fests to smouldering resentathons. It was just moments like these, when it felt like my world was notifications on my phone. Notifications I was trying very hard to ignore, because I knew Mum was right. If I could get through today, they wouldn't matter tomorrow. Though, as it turned out, we were both wrong. Super, super wrong. Chapter 3. Monday started out as it usually did, with me late for work and nobody caring because it was that kind of office. I mean, I say office. It's actually a house in Southwark that's been half-assedly converted to the headquarters of the charity I work for, which happens to be the only charity, or indeed organisation of any kind, that would hire me. It's the red-headed step-brainchild of an elderly earl with a thing for agriculture, and a Cambridge-educated etymologist, who I think might be a rogue AI sent from the future. Their mission? Saving dung beetles. And as a fundraiser, it's my job to convince people that they're better off giving their money to bugs that eat poo, instead of pandas, orphans, or, God help us, comic relief. I wish I could tell you I'm good at it, but really there are no metrics to measure something like that. I mean, we haven't gone bust yet, and what I tend to say at interviews for other jobs I don't get is that there isn't another feces-based environmental charity that raises more money than we do. Also, we're called the Coleoptera Research and Protection Project, the acronym for which is definitely pronounced CRAPP, and definitely not CRAP. Working at CRAP has a number of drawbacks. The central heating that blazes all summer and cuts off all winter. The office manager, who never lets anybody spend any money on anything for any reason. The computers so old they still run a version of Windows named after a year, to say nothing of the daily realisation that this is my life. But there are some perks. The coffee is pretty decent, because the two things Dr. Fairclough cares about are caffeine and invertebrates. And every morning, while I'm waiting for my Renaissance-era PC to boot up, I get to tell jokes to Alex Twaddle. Or rather, I get to tell jokes at Alex Twaddle, while Alex Twaddle blinks at me. I don't know much about him, and I certainly don't know how he got his job, which is theoretically executive assistant to Dr. Fairclough. Somebody once told me he had a first-class degree, but didn't say in what or from where. So, I said, there are these two strips of tarmac in a bar. Alex blinked. Strips of tarmac? Yes. Are you sure? That doesn't seem to make much sense. Just go with it. So, there are these two strips of tarmac, and one says to the other, oh man, I'm so hard. All these lorries roll over me, and I don't even feel it. Then, just as he's finished talking, this piece of red tarmac walks in. And the first piece of tarmac gets up and runs away, and hides in a corner. And his mate goes over to him and says, what are you doing? I thought you were supposed to be hard. And the first piece of tarmac says, yeah, I'm hard, but that guy's a psychopath. There was long silence. Alex blinked again. Why is he frightened of psychopaths? Did he get into an accident? No, it's that he's hard, but the other guy's a psychopath.
Yes, but why is he frightened of cycle paths?
Sometimes I lost sight of whether this was my hobby or a punishment I was inflicting on myself.
No, it's a pun, Alex. Because cycle path, if you say it fast and in a sort of Cockney accent, sounds a bit like psychopath.
Oh!
He thought about it for a moment or two.
I'm not sure it does, actually.
You're right, Alex. I'll do better next time.
Oh, by the way,
he said,
you've got a meeting with Dr. Fairclough at 10:30.
This was not a good sign. I don't suppose, I began, already sure it was hopeless, you have any idea why she wants to see me? He beamed.
None whatsoever.
Keep up the good work. I trudged back downstairs to my office, the prospect of having to interact with Dr. Fairclough hanging over me like a cartoon rain cloud. Don't get me wrong, I have a lot of respect for her. If I'm afflicted by some kind of beetle-related crisis, she'll be my first call. It's just, I've got no idea how to talk to her. To be fair, she clearly has no idea how to talk to me either, or possibly anyone else. The difference is, she doesn't care. As I crossed the hallway, the floorboards creaking merrily with every step, a voice called out,
"That you, Luke?"
Sadly, this was undeniable.
"Yes, it's me."
"Do you mind popping in a moment? We're having a bit of a sticky situation with the Twitter."
Team player that I am, I popped. Rhys Jones-Bowen, CRAPP's volunteer coordinator and head of social media outreach, was hunched over his computer, pecking at it with one finger.
"The thing is," he said, "you know how you wanted me to tell everybody about the Beetle Drive?"
The Beetle Drive is our office nickname for the annual dinner, dance and fundraiser. I've organised it every year for the past 3 years. The fact it's the big ticket item on my current job description tells you all you need to know about it, and, for that matter, my job. I tried very hard to keep my tone neutral.
"Yes, I remember mentioning it sometime last month."
"Ah, well, you see, it's like this. I'd misremembered the password, and I was going to get them to send me another one to the email I'd used to set up the account. But, as it turned out, I'd misremembered the password for that as well."
"I can see how that would cause problems."
"Now, I knew I'd put it on a post-it note, and I knew I'd put the post-it note in a book to keep it safe, and I knew the book had a blue cover. But I couldn't remember the title, or who wrote it, or what it was about."
"Couldn't you," I asked carefully, "have reset the password on the email?"
"I could have, but by that stage I was a bit scared to see how far the rabbit hole went."
To be honest, this happens a lot. I mean, not this precisely, but something along these lines. And I'd probably have been more concerned if our Twitter account had more than 137 followers. "Don't worry about it." He put out a hand to reassure me.
"No, it's okay. See, I was on the loo, and I always take a book in with me, and I sometimes leave a couple in there in case I forget, and I see this one on the windowsill with a blue cover, and I take it down, and I open it, and there's the post-it. And it's a good job I was already sitting down, because I fair near shat myself, I was that excited."
"Lucky on both counts." Somewhat keen to move past the toilet, I continued. "So, if you've got the password back, what's the problem?"
"Well, you see, I seem to be running out of letters."
"I emailed you with what to say. It should definitely fit."
"But then I heard about these things called hashtags. Apparently it's very important to use hashtags so people can find your Twitters on the Twitter."
To be fair, he wasn't wrong about that. On the other hand, my faith in Rhys Jones-Bowen's social media optimization instincts were not exactly running at a historic high.
"Okay. I've been brainstorming a lot of different ideas, and I think this is the tag that describes what we're trying to achieve with the Beetle Drive."
With a quite unwarranted air of triumph, he slid over a piece of paper on which he had painstakingly handwritten, #, Coleoptera Research and Protection Project Annual Fundraising Dinner and Dance with Silent Auction of Etymological Specimens, also known as the Beetle Drive, at the Royal Ambassador's Hotel Marylebone, not the one in Edinburgh. Tickets available from our website now.
And now, he went on, it's only letting me put another 42 letters in.
You know, once upon a time, I used to have a really promising career. I've got an MBA, for fuck's sake. I've worked for some of the biggest PR firms in the city. And now I spend my days explaining #s to a Celtic twit. Or not. I'll make a graphic, I told him. He perked up.
Oh, you can Twitter a picture, can you? I read people respond very well to pictures because of visual learning.
You'll have it by lunchtime. And with that, I headed back to my office, where my computer was finally up and running and wheezing like an asthmatic T-Rex. Checking my email, I was disconcerted to discover a handful of supporters, quite significant supporters, had pulled out of the Beetle Drive. Of course, people were flaky, even more so when you wanted them to give you money, and especially when it was money for dung beetles. But something about this made the hairs on the back of my neck prickle. It was probably random chance. It just didn't feel random. I quickly checked our public footprint, in case our website had been hijacked by amateur pornographers again. And when I found nothing remotely worrying, or interesting, I ended up e-stalking the dropouts like the guy from A Beautiful Mind, trying to figure out if there were any connections between them. As far as I could tell, no. Well, they were all rich, white, politically and socially conservative, like most of our donors. I'm not saying dung beetles aren't important. Dr. Fairclough has told me at length several times why they're important, which has something to do with soil aeration and organic matter content. But you need a certain level of privilege to care more about high-end bug management than, say, landmines or homeless shelters. Of course, while most of us would say that homeless people are human beings and therefore deserve to be looked after, Dr. Fairclough would argue that homeless people are human beings and thus plentiful, and ecologically somewhere between insignificant and a net detriment, unlike dung beetles, which are irreplaceable. Which is why she looks at the data, and I talk to the press.
Chapter 4. At 10:30, I dutifully presented myself outside Dr. Fairclough's office, where Alex made a show of letting me in, even though the door was already open. The room, as ever, was an eerily ordered carnage of books, papers, and etymological samples, as if it was the nest of some particularly academic wasps.
Sit, O'Donnell.
Yep, that's my boss. Dr. Amelia Fairclough looks like Kate Moss, dresses like Simon Sharma, and talks like she's being charged by the word. In many ways, she's an ideal person to work for, because her management style involves paying no attention to you unless you actually set something on fire. Which, to be fair, Alex has done twice. I sat.
Twaddle.
Her gaze flicked sharply to Alex.
Minutes.
He jumped.
Oh, yes, absolutely. Does anybody have a pen?
Over there. Underneath the Chrysochroa fulminans.
Splendid!
Alex had the eyes of Bambi's mother, possibly after she'd been shot.
The what?
A muscle in Dr. Fairclough's jaw twitched.
The green one.
10 minutes later, Alex had finally acquired a pen, some paper, a second piece of paper, because he'd put his pen through the first one, and a copy of The Ecology and Evolution of Dung Beetles, Simmons and Ridsdale Smith, Wiley Blackwell, 2011, to rest on.
Okay, he said. Ready.
Dr. Fairclough folded her hands on the desk in front of her.
This gives me no pleasure, O'Donnell.
I couldn't tell if she meant having to talk to me, or what she was about to say. Either way, it didn't bode well.
Shit, am I fired?
Not yet. but I've had to answer 3 emails about you today, and that's 3 more emails than I normally like to answer.
Emails about me? I knew where this was going. I'd probably always known. Is this because of the pictures? She gave a curt nod.
Yes. When we took you on, you told us that was behind you.
It was. I mean, it is. I just made the mistake of going to a party the same night my dad was on ITV.
The consensus among the press appears to be that you were lying in a drug-fueled haze in a gutter, in fetish wear.
I fell over, I said flatly, in a pair of comedy bunny ears.
To a certain class of person, that detail adds an especial element of deviance.
In some ways, it felt almost like a relief to get angry. It was better than being terrified I was about to lose my job. Do I need a lawyer? Because I'm beginning to think that this has more to do with my sexuality than my sobriety.
Of course it does.
Dr. Fairclough made an impatient gesture.
It makes you look like entirely the wrong sort of homosexual.
Alex had been watching the conversation as if it was Wimbledon, and I could now hear him murmuring, "Wrong sort of homosexual," under his breath as he scribbled. I did my best to offer my reply in the most reasonable tone I could muster. "You know, I could really hardcore sue you for this."
"You could,"
agreed Dr. Fairclough.
"But you wouldn't get another job, and we're not strictly firing you. Besides which, as our fundraiser, you must be acutely aware that we don't have any money, making litigation rather pointless from your end."
"What, so you just brought me here to brighten my day with a little casual homophobia?"
"Come now, O'Donnell."
She sighed.
"You must know I have no interest in what variety of homosexual you are. Incidentally, did you know that aphids are parthenogenetic? But unfortunately, several of our backers do. They, of course, are not all homophobic, and I think rather enjoyed having a delightful young gay wining and dining them. That, however, was rather predicated on you being essentially non-threatening."
My anger, like every man I'd ever been with, didn't seem inclined to stick around, and had left me feeling tired and pointless. "Actually, that's still homophobic."
"And you may certainly call them up and explain that to them. But I somehow doubt it will make them more inclined to give us their money. And if you are unable to get people to give us their money, then that rather limits your usefulness to our organization."
Well, now I was scared again. "I thought you said I wasn't going to get fired."
"As long as the Beetle Drive is successful, you may go to whatever bars you please and wear whatever mammalian appendages you like."
"Yay."
"But right now..."
She cast me a cold glance.
"Your public image as some kind of barebacking, coke-snorting, buttockless trouser-wearing pervert has scared away 3 of our biggest donors, and I need not remind you, our donor list is straying perilously close to single digits."
Maybe not the best time to tell her about the emails I'd received this morning. "So what am I supposed to do?"
"Rehabilitate yourself fast. You need to go back to being the sort of harmless sodomite that Waitrose shoppers can feel good about introducing to their left-wing friends and smug about introducing to their right-wing friends."
"For the record, I'm really, really offended by this." She shrugged.
"Darwin was offended by the ichneumonidae. To his chagrin, they persisted in existing."
If I had a single gnat's testicle of pride, I would have walked out there and then. But I haven't. So I didn't. "I can't control what the tabloids say about me."
"Of course you can,"
piped up Alex.
"It's easy."
We both stared at him.
"A friend of mine from Eton, Mulholland Tarquin Jones, got into a terrible pickle a couple of years back over a misunderstanding with a stolen car, 3 prostitutes and a kilo of heroin. The papers were beastly to him about it, but then he got engaged to a lovely little heiress from Devonshire, and it was all garden parties and spreads in hello from then on."
"Alex," I said slowly, "you know how I'm gay, and this whole conversation has been about me being gay."
"Well, obviously I mean a boy heiress, not a girl heiress."
"I don't know any heiresses of either gender."
"Don't you?"
He looked genuinely confused.
Who do you go to Ascot with?
I put my head in my hands. I thought I might be about to cry. Which was when Dr. Fairclough took control of the conversation again.
Twaddle does have a point. With an appropriate boyfriend, I dare say you'd become endearing again very quickly.
I'd been trying very hard not to think about my abysmal failure with Cam at the cellar. Now the memory of his rejection flooded me with fresh humiliation. I can't even get an inappropriate boyfriend.
That is not my problem, O'Donnell. Please leave. Between the emails and this conversation, you've already taken up too much of my morning.
Her attention snapped back to whatever she was doing on her computer with such intensity that I half thought I'd actually stopped existing. Right about then, I wouldn't have cared if I had. My head was swimming as I left the office. I put a hand to my face and discovered my eyes were wet.
Gosh, said Alex, are you crying?
No.
Do you want a hug?
No. But somehow, I ended up in his arms anyway, having my hair awkwardly patted. Alex was supposed to have been a serious cricketer at school, or university, or something. Whatever serious meant for a sport that was basically 5 days of eating strawberries and walking slowly. And I couldn't help notice he still had the body for it, lean and rangy and solid. On top of which he smelled implausibly wholesome, like freshly cut grass in summer. I pushed my face into his designer cashmere cardigan and made a sound that definitely wasn't a sob. To his credit, Alex seemed entirely unperturbed by this.
There, there. I know Dr. Fairclough can be a bit of a rotter, but worse things happen at sea.
Alex, I sniffed, and surreptitiously attempted to wipe my nose. People haven't said worse things happen at sea since 1872.
Yes, they have. I said it just now. Weren't you listening?
You're right, silly of me.
Don't worry, I can see you're upset.
Having dragged myself about 2 inches above rock bottom, I became painfully aware I was crying on the shoulder of the office doofus. I'm fine. I'm still trying to process the fact that, having been basically single for half a fucking decade, I have to get a boyfriend overnight or lose the only job that would have me, working for a charity whose standards for employment are so low that they'd hire you and Reese. Alex thought about this for a moment.
You're right. That is terrible. I mean, we're complete duffers.
Oh, come on, I growled. At least be offended. Now you're making me feel like a total dick.
I'm so sorry, I didn't mean to.
There are times when I almost wonder if Alex is secretly a genius, and we are but pawns in his grand design. You're doing this deliberately, aren't you? He gave a smile that was either enigmatic or just vacant.
In any case, I'm sure you could get a boyfriend easily. You're nice looking, you've got a good job, you've even been in the newspapers recently.
If I could get a boyfriend, I would have a boyfriend. Alex propped his hips against the side of his desk.
Chin up, old thing. We can crack this. Now, do your parents know anybody suitable?
You remember that my dad is a recovering druggie on reality TV, and my mum is an 80s recluse with exactly one friend.
Yes, but I assume they still have a club.
They don't.
Oh, don't worry. Plenty more options.
A pause.
Just give me a moment while I think of them.
Oh, hello, Rock Bottom. Nice to see you again. Do you want to be my boyfriend? After several long moments, Alex perked up like a beagle scenting a rabbit.
What about the chaps you went to school with? Ring them up and ask if any of them has a nice sister. I mean, brother. I mean, gay brother.
I went to school in a tiny village. There were 3 people in my year. I'm not in touch with any of them.
How peculiar.
He tilted his head quizzically.
I assumed you must have been a Harrow man.
You know there are people who went to neither Eton or Harrow.
Well, yes, obviously. Girls.
I was in no state to explain the socio-economics of modern Britain to a man so posh He didn't even think it was weird that you pronounced the T in Moet, but not Merlot.
I can't believe I'm going to say this, but can we please get back to you trying to fix my love life?
I have to admit, I'm a bit stumped.
He fell silent, frowning and fiddling with his cuffs. Then, out of nowhere, he beamed at me.
I've thought of something!
Under normal circumstances, I would have taken this with the giant grain of salt it deserved. But I was desperate.
What?
Why don't you say you're going out with me?
You're not gay. And everyone knows that you're not gay.
He shrugged.
I'll tell them I've changed my mind.
I'm really not sure that's how it works.
I thought these things were meant to be fluid nowadays. 20th century and all that.
This was not the time to remind Alex what century it was.
Don't you have a girlfriend? I asked.
Oh yes, Miffy. I'd quite forgotten. But she's a terrific girl. She won't mind at all.
In her place, I would mind. I would mind a lot.
Well, maybe that's why you don't have a boyfriend.
He gave me a faintly wounded look.
You sound very demanding.
Look, I appreciate the offer, but don't you think if you can't remember you've got an actual girlfriend, you might have trouble remembering a fake boyfriend?
No, you see, that's the clever thing about it. I can pretend that you're my boyfriend, and nobody will think it strange that I've never mentioned you before, because I'm such an utter nincompoop that it could very easily have slipped my mind.
Terrifyingly, he was beginning to make sense.
You know what? I said. I will genuinely think about it.
Think about what?
Thanks, Alex. You've been a big help. I made my way slowly back to my office, where I was relieved to discover I hadn't driven off any other donors in the interim. Then I sat at my desk with my head in my hands and wished. God, I was too fucked up to even know what I was wishing for. Obviously, it would have been nice if my father wasn't on TV, and I wasn't in the papers, and my job wasn't in jeopardy. But none of those things, either together or individually, were really the problem here. They were just a few more dead seabirds bobbing on the outskirts of the oil spill that was my life. After all, I couldn't fix the fact my father was John Fleming. I couldn't fix that he hadn't wanted me. I couldn't fix falling in love with Miles. And I couldn't fix that he hadn't wanted me either. It was while I was wallowing that I came to the realization that Alex hadn't been entirely unhelpful. I mean, he hadn't gone so far as to actually be helpful. Small steps, small steps. But he was, broadly speaking, right, in that people you knew were an effective way to meet people you didn't know. I grabbed my phone and fired up the WhatsApp group, which somebody had recently rechristened Don't Wanna Be All By Myself. After a moment's consideration, I sent a series of siren emojis, followed by Help, Emergency, Queer Avengers Assemble, Rose and Crown, 6 tonight. I was secretly kind of touched by how quickly the screen lit up, with promises to be there. Chapter 5. It was slightly selfish of me to choose the Rose and Crown for the meet-up, because it was way closer to me than it was to anyone else. But since I was the one having the crisis, I felt entitled. Besides, it was one of my favourite pubs, a gawky 17th-century building that looked as though it had been airlifted in from a country village and plonked down in the middle of Blackfriars. With its disconcertingly expansive beer garden and hanging baskets, it was practically its own little island, the surrounding office blocks almost leaning away from it in embarrassment. I ordered a beer and a burger and staked a claim to a picnic table outside. As it was what passed for spring in England, the air was a bit nippy, but if Londoners let little things like cold, rain, a slightly worrying level of pollution, and getting crapped on by pigeons bother us, we'd never go outside at all. I was only waiting a couple of minutes before Tom showed up, which was ever so slightly awkward as fuck. Tom isn't, strictly speaking, a friend. He's a friend-in-law, being the long-term partner of the group's token straight girl, Bridget. He's both the hottest and the coolest person I know, on account of looking like Idris Elba's cleaner-cut younger brother, and being an actual spy.
Well, not exactly. He works for the Intelligence Division of Customs and Excise, which is one of those agencies that exist but never get in the papers. It gets even more complicated than that, because technically I saw him first. We went on a couple of dates, and I thought it was going really well, so I introduced him to Bridget. And she fucking stole him from me. Well, she didn't steal him, he just liked her more. And I don't resent it at all. I mean, I do, but I don't. Except when I do. And probably I shouldn't have hit on him again when he and Bridget went through that bad patch a couple of years ago. They were on a break, so it was less shitty of me than it could have been. And anyway, all it wound up doing was making him realise how much he loved her and wanted to fix things with her. So that felt great. Basically, Tom does to my self-esteem what he does to people traffickers and gunrunners. Although my self-esteem is way less entrenched. "Hi," I said, trying not to dig a hole in the grass and wriggle into it like an endangered dung beetle. Tom gave me a very continental and slightly soul-destroying kiss on the cheek, plonking his beer down next to mine.
"Good to see you. It's been a while."
"Yeah, hasn't it?" I must have accidentally looked traumatised, because Tom went on.
"Bridge is running late. I mean, obviously."
I laughed, nervously. Late is her default. "So, what have you been up to?"
"This and that. Big commercial fraud case. Should be wrapping up fairly soon. What about you?"
From 3 years of hanging out with Tom, I knew that commercial fraud was industry code for something significantly more serious, although I'd never quite worked out what. Which meant having to tell him I was organising a party to raise money for poo bugs was the tiniest bit mortifying. But of course, he looked terribly interested and asked a bunch of really insightful questions, half of which I should probably have been asking myself. In any case, it kept the conversation going until the James Royce Royces arrived. I met James Royce and James Royce, now James Royce Royce and James Royce Royce, at a university LGBTQ+ event. In some ways, it's strange the two of them work so well together, because their name is pretty much the only thing they've ever had in common. James Royce Royce is a bespectacled chef, with a way of expressing himself that... Look, I'm trying to find a tactful way to put it, but... Basically, he's just phenomenally camp. James Royce Royce, on the other hand, looks like a Russian hitman, has a job I don't understand involving unspeakably complex mathematics, and is incredibly shy. Currently, they're trying to adopt, so the conversation very quickly became about the truly hellacious, James Royce Royce's term, amount of paperwork involved in what I'd naively assumed was the straightforward process of getting babies from people who don't want them to people who do want them. I honestly couldn't tell if it was more or less alienating than talking about actual children. Next, we got Priya, a tiny lesbian with multicoloured extensions who somehow managed to pay her bills by welding bits of metal to other bits of metal and selling them in galleries. I'm sure she's genuinely very talented, but I am totally unqualified to judge. She used to be the only other singleton in my immediate friendship group, and many were the evenings we spent drinking cheap Prosecco, lamenting our mutual unlovability, and promising to cash out and marry each other if we were both still alone at 50. But then she betrayed me by falling in love with a married medievalist, 20-something years her senior, and then, even more unforgivably, making it work.
"Where the shit were you on Saturday?"
She hopped onto the table and glared at me.
"We were supposed to be sitting in a corner judging people."
I gave one of those I'm pretending not to be mortified shrugs. "Showed up, bought a cocktail, got the knockback from a pretty hipster, left in disgrace."
"Huh." Priya's mouth quirked into a crooked grin. "So, fairly normal evening for you?"
"I want you to know that while I do have a comeback, that's actually completely fair."
"Which is why I said it. Anyway, what's this great calamity?"
"Bridget," said James Royce Royce, "has not yet graced us with her presence." Priya rolled her eyes.
"That's not a calamity, that's business as usual."
Since waiting for Bridge could last anything between 20 minutes and never, I spilled my guts. about the pictures, the donors, and how I was totally fucked job-wise if I didn't get a respectable boyfriend stat. James Royce-Royce was the first to react.
"That," he declared, "is the most outrageous transgression against all forms of decency. You're a fundraiser for an environmental charity, not a contestant on Love Island."
"I agree." Gorgeous not dating me Tom took a sip of his drink, throat working as he swallowed.
"This isn't okay on any level. It's not my area, but you've got a case for an employment tribunal here."
I gave a sad little shrug.
"Maybe, but if I tank our fundraising by being too gay, then I won't have an employer to tribune."
"Seems like..."
Priya paused to retie the rainbow lace on her docks.
"You've got two options, get fired or get grafting."
This earned her an over-the-glasses look from James Royce-Royce.
"Priya, my darling, we're trying to be emotionally supportive."
"You're trying to be emotionally supportive," she said. "I'm trying to be useful."
"Emotional support is useful, you technical reprobate."
Tom, who didn't have the same fond memories of their bickering, sighed.
"I'm sure we can be both, but I'm not sure we should be encouraging Luke to go along with this."
"Look," I told him, "that's super right on and very kind of you, but I don't think I have a choice. So I need you all to get on board and find me a man."
There was a worryingly long silence. Finally, Tom broke it.
"Okay, if that's what you want. But you're going to have to narrow the field a little. What are you looking for?"
"Didn't you hear me? A man. Any man. As long as he can wear a suit, make small talk, and not embarrass me at a fundraiser."
"Luke, I..."
He pushed a hand through his hair.
"I really am trying to help, but that's a terrible attitude. I mean, what are you expecting me to do? Call up my ex and be like, 'Hey, Nish, great news. I've got a friend with incredibly low standards who wants to go out with you.'"
"Well, the last time I had high standards, the guy dumped me for my best friend."
James Royce-Royce sucked in an audible breath, and suddenly everyone was studiously looking in different directions.
"Sorry," I muttered. Sorry, I'm a bit upset right now, and I use being a prick as a defense mechanism."
"Not a problem."
Tom went back to his beer. It took me a second or two to realize I wasn't sure if he meant not a problem because I'm not offended and don't consider you prickish, or not a problem you're a prick because we're not actually friends. Fucking spies. And it's not like he was wrong. I was asking a lot here. "The thing is," I started picking the label off the nearest bottle, "I've not been able to do the relationship thing for a while. And probably you're all going to spend the next 30 years arguing with your partners over who gets stuck with me for Christmas. But I can't..."
"Oh, Luke,"
cried James Royce-Royce.
"You'll always be welcome at Casa de Royce-Royce."
"Not entirely the point, but good to know."
"Wait a minute."
Priya looked up from her boots and snapped her fingers.
"I've got it. Hire someone. I can think of at least 30 people who'd jump on the gig."
"I can't tell if I'm more disturbed that you're recommending I solicit a prostitute, or that you apparently already know 30 prostitutes."
She gave me a confused look.
"I was mostly thinking of out-of-work actors or performing artists, but whatever works. Though, now you mention it, I think Kevin did a bit of escorting in the late 2000s, and Sven still does pro-domming on the side."
"Wow!"
I put up the world's most sarcastic double thumbs.
"He sounds perfect! Which part of trying to keep out of the tabloids do you not understand?"
"Oh, come on, he's lovely. He's a poet. They won't find out."
"They always find out."
"Okay, so..."
Priya seemed a tad frustrated with me.
"When you said a man, any man, you actually meant any man who fits into a very narrow, middle-class and slightly heteronormative definition of acceptability."
"Yes. I work for an obscure ecological charity. Narrow, middle-class and slightly heteronormative is our target demographic."
There was another lengthy silence.
"Please," I legit begged. You must have some friends who are neither sex workers nor too good for me. Then, James Royce Royce leaned in and whispered something to James Royce Royce. James Royce Royce's face lit up.
That's a splendid idea, Sugarplum. He'd be perfect.
Except I think he married a chartered accountant from Neasden last July.
James Royce Royce looked crestfallen. I yanked the label fully off the beer bottle and crumpled it up. Right. My options thus far, someone who's probably already married, 30 prostitutes, and a bloke called Nish who used to date Tom and will therefore see me as a bit of a come-down.
I didn't mean, said Tom slowly, to make you think that I thought that Nish would think he was too good for you. I'd be happy to introduce you. It's just, from his Instagram, I'm pretty sure he's seeing someone.
Well, I'm fired. I thunked my head onto the table, somewhat harder than I intended.
Sorry I'm late.
Bridget's voice rang clarion-like across the beer garden, and I turned my face sideways in time to see her wobbling urgently over the grass in her ever-impractical heels.
You won't believe what's happened, can't really talk about it, but one of our authors was scheduled to have this massively prestigious midnight release tonight, and the lorry carrying the books to Foyles went over a bridge into a river, and now, not only are half of them ruined, but the other half have been scavenged by extremely well-organised fans, and there are spoilers all over the internet. I think I'm going to get fired.
And with that, she collapsed breathlessly into Tom's lap. He wrapped his arms around her and pulled her in close.
That's not your fault, Bridge. They're not going to fire you over it.
Bridget Wells, my token straight friend. Always late, always in the middle of a crisis, always on a diet. For whatever reason, she and Tom are genuinely good together. And although I'm messed up about Tom because of my own shit, it's kind of nice that she's found someone who sees what an amazing, loving person she is, and who isn't also as gay as a box of ribbons.
Luke, on the other hand, said Priya, is definitely going to get fired, unless he gets a boyfriend.
Bridge honed in on me like a laser-guided date launcher.
Oh, Luke, I'm so pleased. I've been honoured you to get a boyfriend for ages.
I peeled my head off the table. A-plus priorities, Bridge.
This is the best thing ever.
She squeezed her hands together, excitedly.
I know the perfect guy.
My heart sank. I knew where this was going. I love Bridget, but she only knows one other gay person outside our immediate social circle. Don't say Oliver.
Oliver!
I'm not dating Oliver. Her eyes went big and hurt.
What's wrong with Oliver?
I'd met Oliver Blackwood exactly twice. The first time, we'd been the only two gay men at one of Bridget's work parties. Someone had come up to us and asked if we were a couple, and Oliver had looked utterly disgusted and replied,
No, this is just another homosexual I'm standing next to.
The second time, I'd been very drunk and very desperate, and invited him to come home with me. My memories of what happened next were hazy, but I'd woken alone the next morning, fully clothed next to a large glass of water. On both occasions, in uniquely humiliating ways, he'd made it very clear that we each had a league, and his was very much out of mine. He's not my type, I tried. Priya was obviously still narked I'd turned down her prostitutes.
He's exactly the kind of man you said you were looking for, which is to say, incredibly boring.
He's not boring,
protested Bridge.
He's a barrister, and he's very nice. Lots of people have dated him.
I shuddered. And that's not a red